Hi there, my name is Corey Raven, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcast, where we inspire recovery from addiction and discover a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substances or you're already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery, or with family that has walked the walk of recovery, or maybe not, alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories along your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up and let's hit the road as we hit this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and welcome everybody to Crosstalk. We have a wonderful episode for you today. I have Lucky Church with us today, a terrific guy. Lucky, welcome to Crosstalk.
Thank you so much for having me, brother. It's a pleasure to be here.
So excited to have you here. This is a little bit different than some of our other episodes because most of the time we have people who have been on the ground, picked themselves up, and they're talking about how they got on the ground, what they did to get up off the ground, and what their life is like now. But your family has had a lot of addiction, a lot of active addiction, not an awful lot of recovery.
Yeah.
But somehow you've been able to get on a path where you've used that to strengthen yourself and help yourself get have a life that's fulfilled and wonderful. But I want people to know what it's like to have a life that isn't exactly a storybook life, at least to start. I think it is now, but we'll talk a little bit more about what's going on now. Where did you grow up, and tell us a little bit about how that was?
Well, I grew up in the Bronx. The first part of my life actually started in Harlem. So from Harlem to the Bronx with my grandparents. I have very few memories of growing up in the Bronx. I mean, up in Harlem, rather. It's very sporadic and jumping around because there were so many things going on and I was so young. But I mean, this sounds crazy, but I remember the first time I peed on a tree was in Harlem. You know, my dad was, we were walking down the street. He's like, "Hey, you're a boy. You don't have to run to the bathroom. You go here and you pee on the tree," you know, and that's one of the experiences I had. I remember buying crabs on 145th Street from the famous crab lady who sold crabs on the corner. I remember the smells and, but I also remember the abandoned buildings.
How old were you when you were living in Harlem?
I would say 3, 4, 5 around that time. But my memory is so strong. I remember the park across the street from my parents' building. I remember the smell of things that I now know are drugs. You know what I mean? Because when you're young, you just, what's that weird smell?
Talking about like crack burning?
Crack burning, you know, or burning... different liquids that I didn't really know what they were. I always look for what it is. But now I remember when they're paving streets, it always kind of strikes me as weird. And also another smell that used to freak me out as kids was markers. Because a lot of kids would love to smell the markers, but it gave me just like a weird feeling because it reminded me of home in ways that no other kid would really understand unless they were going through that.
Right. So you moved to the Bronx when you were young.
Yeah. It was kind of a thing where my mom just didn't want to take care of me and my brother at the time. She was going through a lot. You know, my dad, now that I know these things, he was going through a lot as well, coming from Vietnam. She dropped me and my brother at Mom Bernadette's house and said, you know, "I'm going to get some milk. I'll be right back." And she just never came back for us.
How old were you?
I think we were 4 or 5. Well, so I was like 4 or 5. My brother was even younger. He was maybe like 2 or 3.
And so she dropped you at a relative's in the Bronx, went out to get milk.
And never came back.
She probably had a fight with the cow or something.
I know. I mean, I thought she had to find her own cow. I was like, you know, where's this cow in Budapest?
Yeah.
but she never came back. And my aunt was 21 at the time. And she was just married herself, trying to have her own family. And she wasn't ready to take care of 2 kids.
21-year-old.
Yeah. So she kept us there for a little while. And then me and my brother Tyrone got separated. He went with my Aunt Denise, and I went with my grandparents, and then we were separated, I think, for about 1 or 2 years. And it's funny, because when you're young, when you separate kids who are young, they literally will forget the other kid, because, you know, you're trying to build a relationship. So for 1.5 years, I totally forgot that I had a brother. I was this solo child, and then I remember him coming back into my life
when I was about 6, 7. Did he come back to live with you? When you
my
were seven?
My aunt Denise couldn't handle taking care of Tyrone by herself. She wasn't making enough money. So she brought us back. And not only that, they thought that both brothers, we needed to be together. So they put us together at my grandparents' house. And then my grandparents were getting money off the system from us. And then we would go to school from there.
So let me ask you, so your dad and your mom weren't in your lives at all?
They were, but they chose drugs over wanting to be directly in our lives.
Okay. And the other relatives you were with, did they have a substance issue?
Oh, yeah.
So everybody around you.
Yeah, except for my grandparents. I think they had other addictions, which was money, but that's a long story. But my aunts, I watched all of my aunts and uncles, except for my Uncle Paul. Shout out Uncle Paul, because if he says I said all my aunts and uncles, he will kill me. But he was the one who never really had any of those issues. He was the one that... Actually, the one that I got compared to all the time. When my grandfather would get mad at me, he would call me Paul.
Was Paul a stabilizing influence?
He was stable. He was the one who was an actor. He was the one who moved out the house early and never wanted to be around it. And my grandfather was also very abusive. Not blaming him for what his kids did, or my aunts and uncles. But I know how abuse has pushed a lot of people into drug use or finding community where they go into the neighborhood or they find other kids who are doing those drugs. And that's actually how my parents met. They met because they were doing drugs together. And then, they created me and my brother.
And when you say abusive, physical abuse, emotional abuse? Or?
Both. Physical, emotional. I remember my mom telling me a story how my grandfather beat her so bad that she ran from him. And she ran to the back room where I used to stay, and she slid under the bed to hide from him. And she slid so hard that she cracked the front of her skull open. And she was bleeding for days, and they took her to the hospital. And a lot of my aunts and uncles told me that my mom was never the same after that moment because she had hit her head, and they don't know if she had like severe damage, but they said there was just something different about her. She was still functional. But it's just a different person. And they said shortly after that is when the drug use started happening and with her and different friends in the community. And then, like, me and my brother are both related on... I have cousins that we're all related on the same side, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So we married into the drug use, kind of. Right. Just, not to be, rude about it, but just being honest. And it was just rampant throughout the family. And my Uncle Ralph, too. He doesn't use drugs. He's a cop.
Oh, so we got Paul and Rob both stabilizing.
They're both on different sides of the family. My Uncle Paul is on my mom's side, and my Uncle Ralph's on my dad's side.
But both stabilizing influences.
Extremely, yeah.
Tyrone, ever get into drugs also, or were you both?
Actually, no. He didn't really. Weed, I would say. And I guess because a lot of people say, because to me, weed is not... it's a drug, yes, okay, but it's different in my opinion, because it's used for medicinal purposes. It's a little different for me. He never got addicted to it, though. He let it go. He would stop for 2 years. He would smoke again a little bit. It was more recreational for him, so I wouldn't say he was an addict. But he sold.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely sold.
So the substances isn't the issue. It's how we use substances.
Yeah.
There are people that will take pain medication as directed when they have pain. And then there are people who take pain medication because, they get physically addicted to it and they can't get enough of it. So it's not the stuff. It's the way we behave with the stuff.
And it's funny you said that. And I think that also caused a problem for me mentally with certain drugs that I had 3 heart surgeries. And they gave me very strong drugs, Oxy, and stuff to really to deal with the pain. And I refused to use it. And I didn't want to use it simply because I know my personality.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that I would have gotten addicted to it, but you just never know with those things. And I never want to be dependent upon that drug to deal with the pain. So I think that helped me build a high pain tolerance. And my doctors were like, you are crazy. They was like, how are you? We just had open heart surgery. Your wounds are still healing. You can barely move, but you're trying to do all this without the pain medicine. I said, look, I'll take the Oxy when it's excruciating. And whatever the lowest dose that you can give me that. But only, I didn't like the hallucinations that I got. There were things that I saw with it that I was like, well, I said, how can anybody be addicted to this? I just saw an elf run across the room that is not there, that kind of thing. And I was always fearful of stepping into that and becoming somebody that I saw in my family. You know, I saw the things that my mom did that she gave up. Like, I remember one of my craziest memories with my mom when she was doing drugs was catching her shooting up and trying to hide behind the kitchen, the stove in the kitchen, with a little bench so I wouldn't see her. And watching my stepfather, Rudy, at the time, doing drugs and shooting up needles while he's almost dying. He's literally shitting blood and throwing up blood, and I'm carrying buckets of blood, you know, from his bedroom down the stairs to dump them in the
toilet. How old are you at this point?
At this point, I'm probably like 10, 11.
Wow.
You know, I'm carrying all this blood up and down the stairs, and I'm trying to hide it from my little brother because he doesn't really know what's going on. So he's sleeping, and I'm trying not to wake him up. But the only thing that was important to him was where was his next hit going to come from. Right. And that was like a big revelation to me at such a young age, to see that something can consume you so much that you didn't care about your family. You didn't care what time of night it was. You didn't care what risk you would put yourself into. Yeah, because this is when they were living in Stamford, Connecticut. So there was a place in Stamford called the West Side. It was like kind of a borderline where all the crazy, not the crazies, but the druggies or, you know, people who would be alcoholics. And he would be there from 12 in the morning to 12 at night. And then these people would be coming in at the house, and I would find drug needles in the bathroom. And that's dangerous for a kid, finding crack vials. You know, my cousin Tim, he would come home and leave crack vials in my grandmother's, not the living room, the bathroom. And my grandfather would find it, and then she wouldn't want to tell that her nephew Tim was in the house. So she, because he wasn't allowed, my grandfather said, I don't want anybody in the house, I don't want your drug family in here. So she would blame it on me and say that, oh, Walter brought that in here. And I'm like, well, how did Walter bring that in here? So my grandfather would strip me and like check my body for needle holes. And I'm like, thinking back, I'm like, first of all, at least I don't think. I don't think people shot up crack. You smoked it for the most part, from what I know. So I was like, why was he looking for needle holes over my body? You know, he would literally make me strip down and check me. And it was like going through that at from 9 years old to about 14, 15 years old, being accused of drugs. A lot of my friends who were accused by people ended up falling into it because, like, well, if I'm being accused of this, I might as well do it. You know what I mean? But that's never a mindset that I
had. So you were going to school during this time. You're doing okay at school?
Yeah, I was doing decent. I always had good grades. I was smart. I would pass all the regents, have the high test scores. My teachers would say my only bad thing was I was a class clown. So I talked too much. But
that's bad?
I was going to say.
Yeah, that was bad.
It's not bad. So from, let's say, 10 to 18, you got through high school. You graduated?
Yeah.
What did you do after that?
I went to college. I actually scammed my way through high school, to be honest.
How'd you do that?
Scam, and I say that with love because all my teachers would kill me. But I was very smart. I just didn't want to go to school. So that's where my addiction came in. I became addicted to partying.
When you say partying, what does that mean exactly?
Like cutting school and, you know, trying to have these wild parties and
alcohol parties?
Alcohol, yeah.
So there was a time where you were partying a lot.
Yeah, I was partying like crazy and drinking. And, you know, there was, 99 Bananas, Cisco. We would put Kool-Aid into the, Hawaiian Punch. Sorry, not Kool-Aid. Hawaiian Punch into OE, Old English, which is how Snoop Dogg ended up creating that drink that came from the hood.
So when you say you stayed away from, substances, you're talking about drugs, but you did have a thing with alcohol.
Well, alcohol and food.
Okay.
Because food is, I was an emotional eater. And I didn't realize it because I didn't have the verbiage to understand that there was something that with food that could actually kill you, and which led to me having heart surgeries and having high blood pressure and so many things that
did you gain a lot of weight?
Oh, I gained so much weight, yeah. I was only up to 280. Which most people wouldn't say, but for me, that was ridiculous.
What do you weigh now?
Right now, I weigh 206.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you go to the gym?
Yeah. I'm like a nut in the gym. And
just before he got here, he What did you do today? What did your day look like?
I went to the gym. Today was a chest day. And then after chest, I did 45 minutes on the cardio machine. And then from there, I did the sauna, steam room, cold plunge, hot tub. Food was really a problem for me. And I didn't realize it until I stopped. And I would look back and I would calculate a meal. And I know what I'm about to say is going to sound ridiculous and like impossible, but this is literally how I would eat every day. Especially knowing now that I'm lactose intolerant in many ways. So I would wake up. This was a typical day. Have a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich with a blueberry muffin, home fries, maybe a bowl of grits. That's breakfast. That sounds like about 3,000-4,000 calories in my mind right now, yeah, just thinking about
2,000,
it. Right. And then that would be early morning. Then I go later on that day, have a snack. So not just one snack. I have like a couple Rice Krispie bars and stuff like that. Again, I'm not thinking about calories and what this is doing to me. Then for lunch, I'll have maybe a full lunch or at least maybe 2 or 3 slices of pizza. Or I would have like a sandwich of some sort. And when I say a sandwich, it would be like
Hero.
A hero. Yeah, exactly. Like ham, cheese, the works, you know, with peppers, all kind of stuff. A bag of potato chips, soda I would drink all day. And then I would have snacks before dinner. And then I would have a huge dinner of like rice, potatoes, all kinds of meats. And then I wouldn't just have one dinner. I would have 2 dinners. And this came from me being a youngster. And then again, I would still eat throughout the night. And as a youngster, what people don't know about me was my grandparents would hide food from us. So they wouldn't allow us. Like our friends would come over and you would see these jars on the table that said snacks. There was cookies, all kind of stuff there. And people were like, well, why are you asking your grandparents for food? I was like, oh, well, we have to. They would tell my friends when they came over, oh, just take what you want. But I couldn't go in the refrigerator. I couldn't eat whatever I wanted when I wanted to. I had to eat on their schedule. They wouldn't feed. They would eat steak and cook for themselves. And then for me, my brother, we would eat lima beans and rice with ketchup. That was like a regular meal for us. And then sometimes they would treat us to other food. So
how did that feel as a little kid? I mean, were you, what was going through your mind?
It was weird. Especially the times when we would sneak cake mix. I'll never forget one time me and my brother talked about this recently. We went into the middle room. We called it the middle room, and we would take boxes of Betty Crocker and just add water to it and eat the cake mix. Or we would find like cans of SpaghettiOs or whatever kind of can we could find and just heat it up on the radiator. Cause our building had the most incredible heat. So you could just boil, you could make Franks on the thing. Like there was a damn grill. But these are the things we were doing to get by. And we had like, at 11 years old, figuring out ways to open cans, like I was in jail or something. It was weird. They fed the dog better than they fed us, you know? But not realizing that was developing something that when I got my first place, I went and bought every snack. I went and bought every ice cream. You know, I bought everything. And I was like, I'm going to eat whenever I want, all day, every day.
So what happened between the time that your behavior was kind of out of control with food and, for that matter, alcohol to some extent? Mm-hmm. What happened between then and now that allowed you to modify or change your behavior? Because as far as I know, you don't go to 12-step meetings.
No.
Therapy? What things did you do to make it so that the person that's sitting in front of me is proper weight, mm-hmm. goes to the gym, takes care of himself, has really good, you know, employment history? Mm-hmm. What the hell did you do to go from what you're describing to where you are now?
You know, honestly, it was a self-reality check because I realized that I got lucky, hence the name. And it all started from a specific moment, my first heart surgery. Shout out to my wife, Yang. I had back pain. And
age were you?
I was 39.
So you jumped ahead to 39. There's a few years between high school and
but
39.
All of this, between that time, when you don't know you have an addiction and you're living in denial, you think everything is okay until you're dead. You have an aha moment or you almost die. And it took me almost dying to wake up to realize that I actually had a problem.
So all those years between, you know, high school years when you were partying and 39, you were kind of on the run, so to speak.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it was, you know, one thing after another, but mostly overeating.
Yeah, overeating. Was
alcohol?
Yeah, and my doctors were telling me, and definitely the alcohol and just drinking and partying and getting drunk and having wild, crazy nights, which my wife can attest to.
When did you get married?
No, well, we're not technically married.
When did you meet her?
In high school. She's been with me the whole way.
So you've been with her the whole time?
Yeah.
What is she, nuts?
Yes, she's crazy. Obviously, to be with me this long, you have to be. But this May will be 29 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she really...
How old are you now?
I'm 46. Just turned 46 in January.
So 7 years ago.
Yeah.
You have a heart event.
Yeah.
And that changed everything.
Everything, because I was in the emergency room. And they couldn't find anything. They were about to send me home. But, you know, my wife forced me to go. And then the black nurse, this is also an important piece to say why representation is so important when you are in hospitals or seeing doctors. Because she was able to pick up on something that she said, you're too young for what I think this is. She said, but for black people, there's certain signs for that can be a red herring that I need to check into. So let me give you a CT scan. And thankfully she did. And she said, oh my God, you're having aortic dissection. Your vessel is bursting. And she said, how bad it is right now that we're going to do surgery and you have a 10% chance of surviving the surgery. So I went from a concert earlier that day with back pain to now in the surgery that's going to change my life. And I had to think, and all I could hear was different doctors' voices that I had met over the years. One, Dr. Sharon Parrish, shout out to you, who, when my blood pressure was around 140 over, I say 80 something, she was warning me then. What are you eating? She was asking me questions, but I was ignoring her because I was like, I'm just eating. Food doesn't do anything, you know?
You're a young guy.
I'm young, I'm healthy, and I was working out even at that time. I could still run a good 5-minute mile. You know, I ran track my whole life. I had great muscle memory, but now here I am in this predicament, my back against the wall, choosing whether I might need a new heart, valves, making all these life decisions and having to be in surgery an hour from that moment and knowing that I could possibly lay down and die. They tell me, call your family. You know, I'm looking at my wife and she's freaking out. And I remember calling my business partner at the time, my former business partner, Ty Hunter, and he just said some words to me that forever changed me. He was like, your story's not over. Pick yourself up. Get in the right mindset. Basically, you'll be fine. Call me after your surgery's over. And I went into that surgery. And what I told myself before I closed my eyes was, you have to remember you did this. I said, as much as you want to blame people, you're going to say, oh, my wife bought cookies in the house, and you know, or this person did this, or my parents abused me, and you're going to say all these things. But you were the one making the decisions as you were walking down this path. You know what I mean? Nobody picked up the cookies and yet put them in your hand. Nobody picked up the liquor and put it in your hand. Nobody forced you to eat, you know, a whole pan of ribs and a whole pan of stuffing and, you know, 3 servings of mac and cheese and all these things that were starting to, you know, keep your blood pressure through the roof so that you might have a stroke. You know what I mean? You have to now be accountable for everything that you do moving forward.
And you thought of that before the surgery.
Oh, yes.
And when you got out of the surgery, did you remember those thoughts?
100%.
And do you think the other side of those thoughts is being responsible for what you've done since then?
100%. Because I was already very positive, especially because of my background, how humble it was, watching so many people in my family struggle, but thinking in an ignorant way that that's the only way struggle looks. Thinking that that's what struggle looked like when, and then hindsight being 2020, you're like, oh no, struggle is different for everybody. Just like success looks different for us all, struggle is different. It's what may be easy for me could be a struggle for someone else. And that's when I learned to be more empathetic and be more graceful towards people.
How do you do that on a daily basis? You know, giving yourself empathy when those kind of more difficult days come up in tough times.
I just remember that every day is growth, and I don't see anything as a bad moment anymore. I look for the blessing in every moment, if that makes sense. Because even if it seems bad, where is this directing me? What is the next thing for me? All right, if I'm being shifted this hard away from something, there must be purpose in it. So now it's time for me to put my what I call my spidey senses up, and I need to feel, I need to understand, I need to, you know, observe. What's my environment? Where am I going? What are some of the intentions that I put for myself? Because maybe this is showing me that there's another route that I need to take to get there. So I don't fight my life. I work with my life.
Sounds to me like you just described living in gratitude.
Yeah. Yes, 100%. 100%. That is perfectly stated. Gratitude is another word that I use heavily. And I've learned that, again, to be grateful. Like, I'm grateful for just waking up. I'm grateful for that my fingers work, that my toes can wiggle. You know, it's the small things now that make me so appreciative.
Right now, you have your own business. Mm-hmm. And what's the business called?
Lucky Church Consulting.
And your clients range, give us a description of the, not the people's names necessarily,
yeah,
but what kind of people are you consulting with? Mostly people in the music business and arts?
Yeah. It's across the board. It can be from, I have one client, David Clale, who is a fashion designer from South Africa. I consult with him. Another, Cordell Robinson, who is not only a cybersecurity guru, but he's also an executive chef. He is the executive chef for Aston Martin Bentley out in D.C. We were with them for many years. I had a former athlete, a track and field athlete, Sonia Richards Ross. We've done deals with the Olympics.
So you're all over the place.
Yeah, all over the place. For me, it's more about the energy and the vibe, and what your goals are, what assets I have that can align with those things, and if I think I can help you get there. It doesn't matter the project. It matters if I really can serve you.
If you had the opportunity to speak to young Lucky now and give young Lucky any advice, what kind of advice would you give? Pick an age, maybe 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old?
You know what? That's a great question, and I'll answer that two ways. Way number one is I would say nothing. And the reason I would say nothing, because knowing what I know now and knowing how important the bumps and bruises of life are, I would want Lucky at all points to experience life the way it was necessary for him on that journey. I'm separating myself from it right now, but I think the beauty of your journey is just how it ends up.
So I guess, you know, the way we close these episodes is I now turn to this camera and I ask everybody, I plead with everybody, like and follow, subscribe. We deserve it. I mean, we're working our asses off here to bring an episode to you, and this is what we're doing, and this is what we love to do. So give us some love back and tell us what you like. Give us some comments. And I want to thank all of you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.